many of these things I just don't see going away. I think that they're for the benefit of the guest and for the employee. So I think that it's going to be important that we are, that we're keeping these things up and it, as we move forward.
Hi, my name is Jason Hall. I'm the president of AMCO, or the American Master Chefs Order. Some history on AMCO. It was formed in 2014 by a group of master chefs, including Bill Franklin, who spearheaded this concept. The idea was to look at the brand, see how we can further develop it and develop the exam going forward to meet ever-changing needs within the industry, to offer a coming together of our guild once you've passed the exam on the other side, and then also to start to develop the training and support needed for candidates as they approach the exam. Our mission is to promote, sustain, and perfect our craft, all while identifying and supporting and inspiring the next generation of candidates as they progress towards becoming an American Master Chef. You can reach us and see more information on our website at AmericanMasterChefsOrder.org. Thank you.
Welcome to today's episode of the AMCO Podcast. We're here today with Chef Michael Vitro from St. Jude's Children's Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. Thank you very much for coming, Chef, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. It was an exciting time to be a chef.
If not exciting, definitely interesting.
Yeah, that's the truth. It's I think with our ability to adapt definitely has been challenged. You know, we're always used to those last-minute adjustments on a line. This is just on a whole nother level.
Well, Chef, it's something that none of us have experienced before. And so, you know, we're looking at what the new normal is going to be. And one thing that, you know, we're going to try to help our, you know, our listeners and colleagues to is, you know, we can't look back and say this is what we used to do. We've got to look forward and say, this is what we're going to do. So your help is going to be extremely, extremely helpful. And we are looking forward to this podcast.
I know for me, I'm extremely excited to hear some insight and to hear about some real working knowledge for somebody who's working directly in the health sector, feeding both patients and staff at the hospital alike. So I know there's going to be some insight here that I'm really excited to be a part of.
Well, I think there's the healthcare industry is pretty broad because it covers not only community hospitals, senior care, all the way up to what we are. St. Jude is a specialty hospital that. You know, operates a little different than a typical hospital. Well, we don't have an emergency department, but we continue to care for patients and their families, as you mentioned. We must keep pushing for cures because our mission is to find cures and save children. So that is a big piece of what we do is the show must go on. So how is it that we keep the show moving?
Well, since you've started to dive into it, can you just give a nice broad overview, a little bit deeper, of St. Jude Children's Hospital and who you feed and the mission behind the company?
St. Jude is a specialty children's hospital that focuses on childhood catastrophic diseases and searching for that cure. So we have a number of different departments doing different kinds of research. And as we care for our patients, we take that knowledge and we share that knowledge around the world. So it's an amazing environment to work in with the far reach that we have. And I see it mostly in the kitchen itself. So our patients are international and domestic. So we have, I've served Serbian dishes and Jamaican dishes, Lebanese dishes, French dishes, Haitian, Creole cuisine, and just regional American fare to patients. We have all sorts of different requests. And so I think from my perspective, this has been one of the most fun chef jobs that I've ever had. Hospitals can get a a reputation for what I'll call quote hospital food, and it's fun to search those things and see the foil top juices and the segmented trays and the things that maybe are a little less desirable. But the fact of the matter is that we're serving real food, we're cooking real food, we're fabricating when necessary. We have the ability to do pretty much anything a patient asks. But for prior to this wackiness that we know of as our new normal, we average about 4,000 transactions a day in retail, and then we have two Starbucks locations and campus catering. Room service is an interesting animal. We have about 75 inpatient rooms, which doesn't sound very large until you think about that there is at least one caregiver, if not two caregivers or a sibling, that may be in our rooms. We try to make families as comfortable as possible. And obviously, if you have a child, you're not going to leave the bedside. So that is amazing. And then we have three housing units that are apartment style living. So outpatients really come through as retail. And so we see about 300 outpatients a day in our retail operation. And with the exception of trying to keep patients home, except for checkups and really helping them with their appointments, we see a lot of those on campus. So that's probably the big difference between St. Jude and, say, a traditional hospital. But we still are inspected by Joint Commission. We still have the room service protocols to follow. We still have the dietary needs. Probably a lengthy answer to your question, but I think it's a unique operation, and it's worth explaining what it is that we do.
No, I think that's a perfect overview. I mean, it sounds like it's very high touch, and at the same time, it touches on every facet of the food service industry. So that's beautiful. Thank you.
Chef, this is Tony Cita. You know, one of the questions I have for you, what are some of your biggest challenges right now, and how are you dealing with them?
So as I mentioned, we have the remote housing units. So if I bullet pointed our biggest challenges, I would say shortages in the grocery stores, social distancing with our 4,000 transactions a day, and our self-service model had to be addressed immediately. There's a certain level of, well, I think we have mixed stations. You know, there were salad bars. There were a couple of areas where even if it was grabbing a bottled beverage or a yogurt. And when we first kicked this thing off, we managed our staffing models, which was wild, and started repositioning people in key areas. So we serve everything now. And that was pretty big, because you kind of have to make staff where you didn't normally have that individual. From the grocery store perspective, the reason this piece was a challenge for us is that our families, one of the things that we've always believed as an organization is let parents be parents. You got to keep some normalcy in their lives. And so if they're staying in their apartments, because depending on the treatment, they could be there for days, weeks, or months, and sometimes longer. And they would go to the grocery store. And then we started having difficulty with the simple things, right? The big joke is the toilet paper. Maybe it's fresh produce. Maybe it's a run on the basics, your eggs, your milk, things that people just gravitate to in times of emergency. I don't think anybody knew really what to expect. Canned goods. So, long story short, we're trying to educate our families to learn how to cope with this, how to live in a place that is not your own. And then on top of that, we threw in, oh, and by the way, your life's going to be a little more difficult now because grocery shopping just got a little harder. So the food service team, the leadership team, got together, knocked our heads together, and in about 30 minutes, we had our primary vendor delivering a refrigerated truck, a refrigerated trailer to park in one of the housing unit areas, and we set up deliveries of staple items that were easy to distribute. So if it was things like packs of cheese, head lettuce, cucumbers, tomatoes, items like that that would be easy to distribute. So all of our housing units have large kitchens in them that normally would be occupied by special interest groups or donations of food. And so then what we did is we took that, and now we're distributing our groceries to the families. So that was another big thing. As I mentioned, we had these donations of food. Restaurants, church groups, business organizations would cook dinner for the families, and they would serve between 80, 100 families a night for dinner. And because of the uncertainty of the way that the virus was passed, we canceled all outside catering. So then food services, on top of arranging the food, we also now are serving catering dinner to these places because we can be sure that we're serving what I'll call the safest food possible and taking care of the families. So those were all really big. Self-service, we're giving away ketchup. Because you imagine kids putting their hands in a container of ketchup packets or hot sauce or barbecue sauce, and you know the hand digs in and they grab them. So now it's would you like your ketchup? Would you like those items? So it was really it was unique to go through all of that. Those were big changes for
me. You know, Chef, knowing a little bit of your operation, you know, you had a buffet style. How has that impacted the way that you're now serving, you know, the doctors and family members and so on that are going through those types of buffets?
So as I mentioned, we eliminated all self-service. So to expand on that a little bit and kind of on the social distancing piece, we actually created an extra dining room in one of the banquet halls on campus. And so we looked at how can we serve as many employees as are necessary on campus and still handle the lunch rush without having too many people in place. So what we did is we simplified the K-Cafe operations. That's the name of our retail operation. And we have walk-up service, but we actually put Lexan shields across anywhere that anyone would be reaching for items, and we staffed it. So when the family comes in, let's just pretend you're going to go up to the grill. So you would go to the grill, you would place your order, and then we would fully assemble everything, the lettuce and tomato that would normally be an option for self-service. We put all those things in place, ask them for their ketchup and mustard, put the lid on the container before it ever gets to the family. And so keeping it that way, doctors would be the same way. Our self-serve salad bar, we just closed it, created some box salads with a decent variety. And then I have a secondary chop salad station that we just opened 2 days a week that we can offer a little more customization. So we just massaged operations to keep people from actually serving themselves at all. So it really, what we did is we increased our hospitality and simplified the guest. Coffee, we no longer allow self-service coffee. We go in there and we put your cream, your sugar. You know, it's almost like getting we actually probably improved our coffee service by adding a little personal touch to it.
And that goes, that also holds true for your napkin service and your flatware and salt and pepper.
Absolutely. So condiment stations are a big thing in what I'll call cafeteria style dining. And everyone would come up to them, and that's where your flatware is. Again, the salt and pepper, all those things. So we decentralized all those and added them to each of the stations. And again, we passed it over. So the flatware was an interesting one because to make that adaptation, we first started with an individually wrapped item, and then we were able to get a hold of some infrared, you know, just wave your hand and get your utensil and its individual drop so that it's still essentially touch-free. So we got a slightly higher quality disposable ware for what it's worth. But yet, having it each one of the stations, we were able to keep people from congregating in smaller areas.
Chef, in the kitchen, in the heart of the house here, has there any changes been made in, you know, how or what sanitation procedures did you have to implement in the back of the house to assure that all the product is, you know, safe? The biggest concern that, you know, we have right now are cardboard boxes, you know, and how are you handling, you know, the cardboard boxes? I mean, are they sprayed, or I'm going to let you answer. I'm not going to guess.
So I think what we have to do is you have to kind of start at the beginning. And the most important thing as people managers, as chefs, as food service leaders, is we have to get the communication clear first. Because when this all came down the pike, as we all know, it happened very rapidly. And then we have, as I'm sure all healthcare institutions and probably all large businesses in general, have a command center. And fortunately, we have some of the greatest doctors in the world. And I think I can safely say that we've got some really unbelievable talent at St. Jude with all of their different infectious diseases and immunology and tons of words that are bigger than my broccoli chopping ability to fathom. But the communication was big. Things were changing daily. Things were changing almost hourly in that first probably week or two. So what we had to do first is we modified the schedule of the staff so that we could have some alternates on hand should we peak or have any sort of, we'll call it an outbreak. We have not. I would like to go ahead and get that out up front. But so we had to modify the schedule. Then management team, including those that were at home, we had regular calls twice a day to communicate any and all changes and directives that came from incident command. And then immediately after those calls, we would have staff huddles. So we always had staff huddle, but this time it was much more critical that we had them. When we were running with with almost our full staff, which had roughly 40 people on per shift, we were dividing them in half, having the meetings outside, and really just taking care of the experience, you know, the change, the staff anxiety, you know, so that was big. So once we got that under control and we explained to everybody and gave them the knowledge, they can move forward, right? So talking chef, an omelet, right? We all learned to make an omelet in the beginning. And you can say, crack two eggs, mix them up, put them in the pan. Or you could give them the proper instructions, you know, whether it's start with a hot pan, start with a cold pan, you know, all of those things that go in. Once they had the tools, they were ready to rock and roll, because they knew this was serious. This was a worldwide thing. This is not Memphis. This is not St. Jude. This is not the United States. This is a global issue. So everybody dug in. And then what we did is we had to ask, what disinfectants and cleaners are we allowed to use, one, in food service, and two, that passes the sniff test, if you will, for our leadership. So we ended up with a peroxide-based disinfectant. It takes 45 seconds for the kill time. And then we designated staff to disinfect all high-touch areas and handles, including areas that normally we would leave to environmental services. So we went in there, we went ahead and took care of the restrooms. We took that off of their hands. We're all drawer handles and beverage nozzles. And we have UV knife holders that go through there. So the biggest thing for us, which we're already trained to sanitize and to disinfect, but it is much different when you have to wait 45 seconds before you go to the next, before you move to the next item. So those were really big. And then we removed all of our curtains in the walk-ins. So I've always hated those things anyway, because if you've ever walked through there with a chef hat, the toque falls off the back of your head. You know, you feel all disheveled. Well, imagine all the touch points on the curtains. So we opted to remove those items. Oh gosh. I mean, it, just in general, they seemed like a great idea because they're saving you a penny on refrigeration. And well, I shouldn't say a penny, right? Because they could save our food if somebody leaves the door open. I'll give them.
No, I get it.
But yeah, but getting those things cleaned disinfected 3 and 4 times a day was a real challenge. And we just said, look, right now we've got temperature monitors and alarms on all of our coolers. Let's get rid of these things and try to free up the staff to do something more important. So those were big things. Distance decals on the floors. I dropped my cooks to 1 chef per station so that we could, instead of worrying about social distancing, we just set up a service model, simplified the menu, and allow 1 person to work 1 station who touches that food. So that from a tracing perspective, we were able to know where it was should it arise. Again, I'd like to say we have not had any of those issues, but I think it's because of our vigilance with disinfecting, setting a 15-minute timer to wash hands. Timer goes off, everybody just spreads out, hits up a hand sink, washes their hands, and goes right back to duty. And everyone, our staff was just amazing at adapting to that.
Well, Chef, that's really amazing. I have a question on that one. Are you doing any record keeping along with that process, or how are you keeping track of who's working what station, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, my schedule is based upon position. So if you work the 23, you are the deli person. If you work the 12, you're hot catering. So it's pretty easy to just, I can go straight back off of a schedule and at any given time and know exactly who was where. And we found that simplifies things just as a whole. And I think that actually came from an adaptation. We're a union shop, and clarification is always important. And so again, you know, back to the education is power. Everybody knows where they are at any given time. And we also have established job routines with who gives the break on which station. So again, we could tie it back to, you know, quite easily.
You know, Chef, one of the things that's, you know, for restaurants that are going to start back up again, you know, this element of trust, you know, you've got customer optics, and now you've got trust that we have to regain. Have you noticed any numbers fall off from the number of people serving? Are you still having, you know, the numbers that are pretty much remaining the same?
So our business is based upon who is on campus. So there was a directive from the incident command that anyone who is able to work from home was, you know, is allowed to do that. And so we watched our numbers drop quite a bit over the course of, again, a few weeks, which, as I get back to the conversation of meeting with the management team and then meeting with the staff after the fact, was that we were regularly analyzing our transactions and our production lists for how much food we were preparing. Because for a cook who's ready to go on autopilot and make 275 to 300 portions of 3 or 4 different items for their station, to then all of a sudden put the screeching halt on there and shut it down, we had to really pay attention to over prepping for substituting fresh products, such as, let's just use an example. Say I was using frozen Herico Vert or some type of frozen vegetable. Well, we automatically were substituting that with items that were fresh from the produce, because we didn't know what the day was going to bring, how many people would be on campus until for probably about a week and a half, as everybody started cleaning out their offices and getting used to being off campus. Bananas were a big thing for us, the number one hand fruit in the world. And we're going through 4 cases a day, and we had to figure out what the magic number is, which for us is about a case and a half. And then we make a lot of banana bread and bread pudding, or banana pudding, to offset the waste. But the trust, so as we look at trust, I have to say that I can attribute a lot of the trust to the St. Jude family, just understanding that we are doing everything possible that we can do. We did spend a little bit of time chatting with our with our occupational health and with our infectious disease department to actually to clarify exactly what they needed from us. And I think the other thing was is that we were quick to act as a food service department without being told to do so. We have a lot of, we'll call them friends, all over the country. We were listening to what everyone was doing, and we wanted to be the first to do it. So when it came time to separate seats in the dining room, we actually eliminated tables, moved chairs, and forced those that were going to dine in the dining room to actually separate themselves. They had no option. There was no sitting two tables next to each other like there would have been. So I think that they saw us move fast, and I think that we built that up. From the restaurant perspective, those restaurants that continue on proving how clean they are and the safety that they are, that they, how seriously they're taking this for their guests, are going to be the ones that are going to recoup the fastest. They're going to, guests want to see that. You know, they want to see that they're being taken care of, because there is a lot of pride in St. Jude. But I think that regular restaurants are gonna have to stick to a lot of the things they've started.
Chef, are you doing anything to vet or check your employees at the hospital in order to have confidence that they're not spreading the disease? And if so, what is that?
In addition to just standard food health and safety standards that we are always following, we are, you know, wearing masks, physically distanced. Those are really the most important things that we have been told to follow. So disinfect, wear your mask properly, and keep your space. Temperature checking has not been deemed necessary for us, but they are going through some other steps as far as, you know, making sure that each employee as they come in fully understands.
All right. I mean, this has been fantastic because, you know, like one of the things that you're saying now, are you wearing masks or being worn both out on the line and then also back in the kitchen? And what is your take on wearing of gloves?
So as far as gloves are concerned, I would say that, you know, following just standard, you know, ANSI standards, you can, you know, wear your gloves. You have to wash your hands in between the changing of gloves. You don't wear those gloves for consecutive tasks. And then, as I said, every 15 minutes, we're stopping to wash our hands. The only caveat to that is if you are in the middle of a project, like say you're marinating something, and I don't want you to stop just to do that. I want you to get that job over with. But everyone else who is just touching a set of tongs or is maybe shuffling around some items and tidying up their station, they stop and they wash their hands. So we've been told gloves are fine, and to stick with that. And then, you know, that's only as good as your hand washing, and it's only as good as your regular sanitation. But the masks we're wearing all the time. So we actually had to ask for, we had to instruct our staff on how to taste your food, because how can you wear a mask 90% of the time that you're working and still be sure that the food is going to taste correct? So, you know, that's one of those culinary things. It's like, oh my gosh, you want me to cover my mouth? How am I going to taste my food? But we have to be extremely careful. You pull it off from around your ear. You take the taste. You keep your hand on that mask, put it back over, and go wash your hands. And then, you know, and re-glove. So that's probably been an interesting challenge from the culinary standpoint. But we're always wearing masks everywhere, all day long.
Who would have expected? So, Chef, what are some, I mean, truly, like, I don't think anybody thought they'd be sitting in the chef's office with a mask on or, you know, chopping onions with a cover over their face. So, I mean, We've went over some specifics, but you know, in an open-ended fashion, what are some other changes you see coming down the line, and how are you preparing for them, or what are some of the things you're trying to anticipate?
So in tough times like this, I think a lot of our our inner chefs, our first classes is we're going in there and going, how do you streamline items? How do you do less more often? How are you, as we're looking at supplies and supply lines and potentials for shortages, thank heavens we haven't seen them now, but there's always a possibility. But I think there are going to be SKUs that are going to start disappearing. Many of the things, I was on a call this morning with a group of colleagues, and they were mentioning that they purchased a lot of items that the CMU group were purchasing, and then they were no longer on the shelf. The schools were closed, but they just were not carrying those items. So I think that a lot of the variety that we're seeing right now is probably going to disappear, and so I think we're going to need to learn to adapt and figure out what are those items that we really want to make sure that our primary vendor is stocking. We are increasing our app-based ordering. This is something where, you know, we already have menu screens, but we're trying to go completely touchless because our cashiers, you have to imagine, they're touching money. Well, money has always been considered to be, you know, not completely clean. And so now, how can we do cashless as much as possible? So we've definitely expanded our food service pickup, kind of Grubhub style dining, and that, and I think the sanitation, I think, is just going to be huge. I just don't. We're already trained to take it to this next level of disinfecting. So I see that as being a really big opportunity. Is that we are going to make it safer to dine, and that peace of mind is really important to us.
Well, Chef, do you foresee money being totally eliminated from your operation? Cash money and credit cards or something similar to that used only?
So I think as the next generation of students are coming out of the universities, I think that we're going to see that is going to be a trend for the future period. I think we already saw that coming. A lot of people really do like using cash.
Yeah, I grew up in a family where the idea of cash going away would never, ever truly be a full-on thing. I don't think people are truly going to let go of that one. But I think from your organizational standpoint, it makes perfect sense to, you know, to stop that person-to-person transfer.
No, I think you're right. I mean, cash is always going to be out there, right? There's always going to be a certain level of mistrust with the digital world. And it's nice to spend money because you can see it being spent. But as we move forward, I think that it's just the way we're going. Same thing with all of these delivery services that we're using now, everything from the, you know, the Amazons of the world, all the way through to the Grubhubs and Uber Eats and those things. It's just more convenient. And life is really about convenience, because I can't really speak for someone in a more densely populated area like a New York or a San Francisco, but I can imagine it's been a lifesaver to have things delivered to them as they are sheltering in place. So I think that it's just, I think people are getting accustomed to it.
You know, just to address that fact too a little bit, and some of the things that I, you know, we foresee, you know, that delivery systems, you've got your own people delivering. And I think that's where restaurants could actually extend their employees to actually making those deliveries, you know, rather than trusting a particular app, because you really don't know what's going to happen or how that person that's in charge of that particular app is going to take care of the food, because somebody under your jurisdiction is going to handle the food a lot better. The other thing too is, as food is left from, you know, when you deliver it, are there seals put on the food, you know, to secure them, or how do you handle that?
Well, let's just take room service as an example. So with room service, they would already have some type of a domed lid or would be fully snapped together. And the beverages, say they ordered a canned soda, a bottled water, we actually put those in Ziploc bags. So yes, they are sealed. When it comes to the only catering we're doing right now is for incident command, and everything that we produce comes individually wrapped and covered. And again, you know, what we have is we've established trust that this is an internal operation and that we're following all of the guidelines. But apples. So when this first hit, we took apples out of the cake, out of the cafe, because the skin was exposed, right? That was something that would be ready to eat right from there. And so we left bananas and oranges out there, but we brought apples back and only kept them in room service. And then when I am serving apples, we are washing them and bagging them and putting them out in smaller numbers and just keeping the supply par level up instead of having that. Because there's peace of mind in that. We expanded some of our things, like say blueberry muffins. We kind of, for the time being, we're purchasing those in a fully wrapped commercial grade packaging, because again, it's peace of mind for the guest. We'll still be passing it to you. We're not going to let you touch it yourself, or maybe move one out of the way to get another one. But there's that, you know, it came from a company that has a HACCP plan that we should be able to trust.
Well, HACCP, I definitely think is going to be, it should be becoming a bit more prevalent, or it's something that we as companies and as restaurants and as food service providers should be looking into more, with, you know, standard operating procedures and ensuring that the food has a proper, you know, path of travel into an organization and then through an organization. I see documentation going, you know, definitely becoming more a part of the forefront of food service management as accountability starts to become more and more prevalent.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because it comes all down to tracing, right? You need to be able to get it back to that one item, wherever that may be, whether it's coming out of your blast chiller or whether it's checking your temperature logs. So, you know, we do use digital temperature checking devices that then upload Wi-Fi. So we know, based on the menu rotation and the item, we could trace it right back down to every 2 hours, those temperatures. So I think you make a great point. I think that anything that we're doing now is just going to be put on steroids. But I don't think the healthcare industry is going to forget. I think that we're one of the few groups that are going to really truly take this to heart, even as regulations or government administration starts to allow people to reintegrate. I think that the healthcare is going to be kind of in the same spot.
You've been extremely helpful in, you know, what's going on in your facility. But, you know, one of the things that I am really happy to see are the HACCP programs, not only from the food manufacturer's point of view, but also for restaurants. I know when I was in Florida, they were initiating the program when I was with Perkins Restaurants, and these were things that were recorded, and it was, you know, done on a regular basis, because we had to know what those critical control points were. And I think that something like this is going to probably be initiated across the United States for restaurants to, you know, reopen, that they've got some type of procedure. And I think Chef Petros mentioned it, a means of tracking those particular, you know, products. I know there are companies out there that have systems that they can date product. And I think it's going to be, the name is going to be on there of the cook that prepared it, the time that was done. So this tracking mechanism is in place. So in case that there is something that may occur, that we've got ways of tracing it.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I agree. I
challenge that most of our, you know, colleagues are going to have is regaining the trust of their, you know, their patrons. You know, I wanted to see that, you know, you do have, you know, that trust and how you've developed that trust. You had a customer optic that was there that they now believe in, because this is a standard of operations that you now have enforced into your kitchens. So it's very, very great to see, and I'm very happy that you had an opportunity to come over and discuss this with us and, you know, help some of our colleagues understand what's going on right in the world now for those of us that are still open?
Well, you know, my pleasure. I think that I think the restaurant industry is an amazing place. There is one thing that we know how to do, and that's to adapt and to figure out how to move forward. And we've only ever been as good as our last dish. So now we're just using that same mantra as we go forward. So for those who are getting ready to reopen that are getting a chance to hear this, I hope that maybe one thing that we're doing will help you get that trust, or maybe you're already doing it. And I think you should pat yourself on the back for recognizing what needs to happen in order to take care of your guests. Thanks for the opportunity, chefs.
No, that's amazing. Thank you so much for being a guest. We loved having you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It what a pleasure.
On behalf of AMCO, I would like to thank everyone for listening today. This will be an ongoing series going forward. If you heard any topics today that you would like us to expand upon on a future episode, please feel free to contact us with questions or topics. You can reach us at podcast@AmericanMasterChefsOrder.org. Thank you.